Okay. Today's lecture is on religious revivals, and it sort of goes in tandem with last week's film on Salem and the notes that I gave you, the previous week to that, about the religious experience in America from 1700, in this case, through to the 1770s. And mainly I'm going to talk about something which, a phrase which you'll come across quite a bit, something called the Great Awakening, which is a somewhat broad term, an all-encompassing term, relating to religious revivalism, starting in roughly the late 1720s, and it carries right through the 1730s and 40s, and even as late as the 1760s. So it's not a specifically defined event in time, it's sort of like a movement, I guess. And certainly contemporaries at the time didn't necessarily talk about the Great Awakening as an event. It's a 19th century term that is coined to look back at early America, from a sort of 100 years later. How can we spot the Great Awakening when we're looking at historical records? Well, partly by increased numbers of people attending church, partly by the increasing number of churches. The idea being that they wouldn't have built more churches if they didn't have more people to go to those churches. So partly we're talking about statistical numbers game, but we're also talking about the differences, the evolution of different styles and meanings of worship, which are different to what have gone before. Some argue, maybe not all, but some argue that the Great Awakening is about severing links between Britain and America. Others, however, say that there are a very strong links between English and American evangelicals. So perhaps that argument doesn't hold as much weight as we first thought. Some see it as having a class bias and talk about it being a movement of lower class protest. But you can also look at the importance that it held for certain elites and how they used it for their own ends. You can also think about the Great Awakening as being about the development of the American colonies as a unit, about the unification of those colonies as a way for those to be united. However, the Great Awakening, you can also say it's very localized. There are some areas which don't have the experience of the Great Awakening at all. And you might also think about the link between the Great Awakening and the American Revolution, something I'll talk a little bit about towards the end. So, as I said earlier, it's not something that's fixed in time. It is quite amorphous, quite diffuse, quite difficult to get your head around and put your finger on it. Not least because it has differing regional chronologies. It's particularly prevalent in New England in the 1730s and 40s. Further south in Virginia, it's much more like the 1750s and 1760s. So it's always, changing, affecting different populations at different times. Looking at, why people become more religious in the 18th century, and as a whole in the American colonies they do, I think a lot of it has to do with sort of a crisis of confidence that people almost think, by the mid-18th century, America is increasingly prosperous, cosmopolitan, diverse. Is this taking us too far away from our spiritual roots? Do we need to anchor ourselves back in Christianity? And how do we do that? Well, partly it's done because the Great Awakening is all about emotion. It's all about heart. It's not about rational thought. It's not about theologians talking at great length and discoursing, convincing people by the weight of their arguments and the spirituality of their arguments about Christianity. It's not about that. It's much more about emotion. And it's making a religion a much more sensual, not sexual, but sensual experience. It's about how people experience religion. It's not just being talked at, like I'm talking to you, but it's about you taking something out of that experience. It also is an evolution away from really strict doctrines of Calvinism. Doctrines of Calvinism, which talked about evil, but not only evil, inherent evil. You couldn't escape your sin. Only God can, help you through your sin. Evangelicals talk a lot more about love. You know, and it's much more fun to talk about love than it is to talk about evil. It's much more attractive. That does have an audience. And it's popular, particularly, for those people who Puritanism is overlooking. This, you know, people who are sinners and who recognise the fact that they're sinners, often the poorest members of society, the marginalised members of society, you know, non-whites, for instance. This sort of evangelicalism is popular amongst those. But a lot of the success of the Great Awakening, and why it becomes so important so quickly, is to do with the individual styles of key figures, key preachers, who bring Christianity to the people in a new, innovative, really sort of exciting way. And that's a lot to do with the style of the Great Awakening, is these individuals, these preachers. Let's talk about George Whitefield, probably the most famous of the Great Awakening ministers. An Englishman, born in 1714. He attended Pembroke College in Oxford. He was close friends with the Wesley brothers, Charles and John Wesley. You know, they would later, of course, go on to found Methodism. And when he was with the Wesleys, he was part of what's called the Oxford Group. And the Oxford Group is basically a sort of discussion group, theological discussions, questioning some beliefs about Anglicanism. But Whitefield's also a pragmatist, a bit of a realist, and realises that if he rejects Anglicanism while he's still at Oxford, then he'll be sent down. He won't be allowed to stay at Oxford and finish his education. So he stays within the Church of England for the time being. And actually his decision is in many respects reminiscent of Puritans staying within the Church of England, trying to reform it from within, rather than leaving the Church of England and trying to, you know, sort of create your own church from without. And eventually he becomes ordained as an Anglican minister. Whitefield believes that he has a mission to spread the word of God, and he's particularly interested in spreading the word of God to those who either have no access to ministers, no access to religion, or those who have never even heard about religion. And it's almost inevitable that he gets drawn towards America. In 1737, his friend Wesley, John Wesley, had been appointed minister at Savannah in Georgia. This is the new colony of Georgia. It's only been around 3 or 4 years. And he's the one who tells Whitefield that Georgia is somewhere that is ripe for evangelicals to come and visit. It's absolutely crying out for somebody to come and evangelise. Wesley, incidentally, is sort of handed out of Georgia under a bit of a cloud. Which is slightly ironic, considering they do celebrate the fact that he was a minister in Georgia. The Methodists in Georgia celebrate the fact that he worked there. He basically was had his eye on this young woman, a woman called Sophia, and she was the niece then of one of the leading figures of Georgia. And basically, Wesley didn't get his act together, and eventually Sophia gave up on him and went off and married somebody else. And he then, in a complete huff, decided that he wasn't going to give her communion, which is sort of like saying she'd done something wrong. Well, in fact, she hadn't done anything wrong. He just hadn't sort of put himself forward. And because he denies her communion, there's a great big uproar in Savannah, and because her uncle is a key figure in Savannah, they actually issue a warrant for his arrest, and Wesley flees the colony, and flees to Charlestown, and gets on the next boat back to London. So he does leave under a bit of a cloud. Anyway, he's replaced with his friend George Whitefield, who arrives in early 1738. He's famous for lots of things, but in Georgia he's particularly famous for the Bethesda Orphanage, which is a state-run orphanage. It's the only one of its kind in colonial America. And Whitefield starts preaching and starts raising money through preaching, partly to fund his orphanage in Georgia, to support the orphans and the children that he's looking after. There's an example of Whitefield exhorting the populace. Whitfield is generally quite popular in Georgia. He's a charismatic man. He writes, he keeps journals and diaries and writes lots of letters. In Savannah, he talks about them hearing the word gladly, and the people everywhere receive me with the utmost civility, and they are not angry when I reprove them. I'm not sure that's entirely true, but that's what he writes. And when he goes outside of Savannah, Savannah's the main settlement in Georgia, but when he goes out to remote settlements, he also talks again about the people receive me most gladly, having had a famine of the word for a long season. That people are desperate to have the light of Christianity brought to them, and he's the one bringing it. He's very conscious of the fact that you need to bring Christianity to the people. You can't expect the people to come to Christianity. You need to make it accessible and understandable to them. So he talks about God and redemption in very simple, plain language, but it's also very dramatic. The typical sermon greatly emphasises man's inherent sinfulness. We are all sinners, we cannot help but sin, and this is what's going to happen to you if you don't sort yourselves out. They're great at things like describing hell and all, Beelzebub's little demons and what they're going to do to you and how they're going to chop your toes off and roast them over an open fire. All these sorts of things. They go basically terrify the people who are listening. But then, once he's sort of painted this terrible image of hell, he would talk about, coming to God, giving yourself to God, seeking forgiveness. God will give you forgiveness. All men can be saved. And the idea is that you sort of take people to the brink of this sort of emotional wreckage, and then you save them. You say, but actually, I've got the solution. You come to me and you can be saved. And, that sort of emotional journey is what helps to increase the number of converts to Christianity, new adherents to Christianity, I should say. One of Whitfield's most famous sermons is a so-called thunder and lightning sermon, where he was preaching in a church, and as he preached, the skies darkened. And as he got to the middle of hell, the rain lashed down, the lightning flashed, the thunder crashed. And then, as he got to the bit about God giving forgiveness, the storm quietened, a rainbow appeared, and a printer, a local journalist, came up to him afterwards and said, that was the most amazing sermon I ever heard, you must let me print it. And he said, well, you can print it, but you have to include all the thunder and lightning, because that really made it. So he wasn't without irony and humour. So, Whitfield is also known as the Great Itinerant. He is one of the most mobile people in early America. He starts out in Georgia. He then crosses over to South Carolina, a much bigger, more populous province. He's very popular amongst the people in South Carolina, but he's not with the Anglican church authorities, who eventually ban him from preaching in any of the pulpits in South Carolina. So, Whitfield's solution? Preach outside, in the open air. Which, of course, means he can reach even more people, reach a much bigger audience. And this, I'm going to read you the extract of a diary of a man called Nathan Cole, a New England farmer who was awaiting Whitfield's arrival. Now it pleased God to send Mr. Whitfield into this land. And my hearing of his preaching in Philadelphia, like one of the old apostles, and many thousands flocking to hear him preach the gospel, and great numbers were converted to Christ. I felt the Spirit of God drawing me by conviction. I longed to see and hear him, and wished he would come this way. And I soon heard he was coming to New York, and the Jerseys, and great multitudes flocking after him, under great concern, more and more hoping soon to see him. But next I heard he was at Long Island, and then at Boston, and next at Northampton. Then one morning, all of a sudden, about 8 or 9 o'clock, there came a messenger and said, Mr. Whitfield preached at Hartford and Wethersfield yesterday, and is to preach at Middletown this morning at 10 o'clock. I was in my field at work. I dropped my tool that I had in my hand and ran home, and run through my house and bathe my wife, get ready quick to go and hear Mr. Whitfield preach at Little Town, and run to my pasture for my horse with all my might fearing I should be too late to hear him. I brought my horse home and soon mounted and took my wife up and went forward as fast as I thought the horse could bear. But when my horse began to be out of breath, I would get down and put my wife on the saddle and bid her ride as fast as she could and not stop or slack for me except I bade her. And so I would run until I was much out of breath, and then I would mount my horse again. And so I did several times to favour my horse. We improved every moment to get along, as if we were fleeing for our lives, all the while fearing we should be too late to hear the sermon. We had 12 miles to ride, double in more than half an hour. And we went round by the upper housing house. And when we came within half a mile of the road that comes from Hartford, Wethersfield and Stepney to Middletown, on Highland, I saw before me a cloud or fog rising. At first I thought it came from the great river, but as I came nearer the road, I heard a noise, something like a low, rumbling thunder, and presently found it was the noise of horses' feet coming down the road. This cloud was a cloud of dust made by horses' feet. It arose some rods into the air over the tops of the hills and the trees, and when I came within about 20 rods of the road, I could see men and horses slipping along the cloud like shadows. And as I drew nearer, it seemed like a steady stream of horses and their riders, scarcely a horse more than his length behind another, all of a lather and foam with sweat, their breath falling out of their nostrils in the cloud of dust, every jump. Every horse seemed to go with all his might to carry his rider to hear the news from heaven for the saving of souls. It made me tremble to see the sight, how the world was in a struggle. I found a vacancy between two horses to slip in my horse, and my wife said, "Lord, our clothes will be all spoiled. See how they look," for they were so covered with dust that they looked almost of a colour, coats, hats, shirts and horses. We went down in the street. I heard no man speak a word all the way 3 miles, everyone pressing forward in great haste. And when we got to the old meeting house, there was a great multitude. It was said 3,000 or 4,000 people assembled together. We got off from our horses and shook off the dust, and the ministers were then coming to the meeting house. I turned and looked towards the great river and saw ferry boats running swift, forward and forward, bringing over loads of people. The oars were nimble and quick. Everything, men, horses and boats, seemed to be struggling for life. The land and banks over the river looked black with people and horses, all along the 12 miles. I saw no man working his field, but all seemed to be gone. When I saw Mr. Whitfield come upon the scaffold, he looked almost angelical. A young, slim, slender youth, before some thousands of people, with a bold, undaunted countenance, and my hearing how God was with him everywhere as he came along, it solemnized my mind, and put me in a trembling fear before he began to preach. For he looked as if he was clothed with authority from the great God, and a sweet, solemn solemnity sat upon his brow. And my hearing him preach gave me a heart for him. By God's blessing, my old foundation was broken up, and I saw that my righteousness would not save me. Then I was convinced of the doctrine of election, and went right to quarrelling with God about it, because all that I could do would not save me. And he had decreed from eternity who should be saved, and who not. So here you've got an example of one farmer, and the impact that just the news of Whitfield's coming had on him. The fact that he raced home and he ran a half road all the way to Middletown in order to see Whitfield preach. And the impact that Whitfield had on him, he talks about his old foundation being broken up. He is going to be a new person, a new man, a new beginning. This is the sort of electric effect that Whitfield had in every single community that he preached in. And he preached throughout North America. So, he preaches throughout New England. New England, of course, had a propensity to religion, we know that. But he also talks to quite a lot of mixed racial crowds, not only whites, but blacks as well. And again, that's quite unusual to preach to blacks. Benjamin Franklin, no less, went to see him preach in Philadelphia. Franklin went partly out of scientific curiosity, because Franklin had heard all these reports and all these thousands of people, and he was sure, convinced himself, that thousands of people could not possibly hear one man preach. It was just not possible. So he conducted an experiment. He went to hear Whitfield preach to Philadelphia, and Whitfield was preaching on like the steps of a church. And Franklin walked backwards until he could no longer hear him. And then he calculated 2 foot per man and how far he'd walked. And he calculated that actually you could fit about 10,000 people in that space who could have heard him. And he was quite pleased that he did that sort of scientific calculation. Quite pleased with himself. So yes, this mobility was really important for Whitfield. The fact that he was able to preach in lots of different places and reach such a massive audience. He wasn't averse to hardship either. We all know that crossing the Atlantic takes about 3 months. He did it 13 times. And he was only 56 when he died at the age of, in 1770. He wasn't the only preacher, of course, but he was the inspiration to many other types of preachers. And actually, he helps to spread revivalism beyond his immediate circle. Other people take up the baton because of Whitfield's influence. And this actually is Whitfield's portable travelling preaching platform. You could almost patent that, couldn't you? In that he would take it collapsible and he would take it around and then he'd set it up until he could stand up and preach. People could hear him. See him. And a lot of the reports of Whitfield always talk about his angelic face. He was a very sort of young, you know, young looking man. These are some of the other preachers who are important. This is Daniel Bliss. He was the minister at Concord, Massachusetts in the late 1730s. He arrives and the church is in a complete disarray, partly because the previous minister had been sacked for being drunk, which is never a good sign, is it? Not many people went to church when Bliss arrived, and most of the people who actually were full church members, the people who controlled the church, were elderly women. But within 2 years, it turned around completely. Charismatic preaching, you know, such as the sermon here. I mean, you can't read this, but these are the sorts of really tiny, detailed sermons that he would write. And you know, often they would be printed and circulated as well. He produced 100 new church members in his congregation, doubling the size of his church. And he's only one example. You know, others include the famous Jonathan Edwards. He's, again, a New England minister, this time in Northampton, Massachusetts. He actually started this sort of revivalism before Whitfield ever came to America. You know, as early as the 1734. Theologically, he's different, he's distinct from Whitfield, but he uses the techniques. His most famous sermon here is Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, again published and circulated. And if you read Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, you really do get the sense that, you know, God is really mad at you personally for what you've done. He talks about the sword of Damocles hanging over humanity, just hanging by its thread, waiting to be cut, plunged into your heart, your sins. But the fact that Edwards, Puritan, could use the Great Awakening's techniques of revivalism, and it could also be used by an Anglican like Whitfield, shows that it could be flexible, could be used by various different people. It wasn't a monolithic thing, it was a quite varied event. Here's two more. Samuel Davis, in Virginia, in the 1750s mainly, but he was also president of Princeton in the 1750s. And this man here is Gilbert Tennant, responsible for a much evangelicalism in the middle colonies, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and New York. And this is the new college of Princeton, founded in 1746, founded in a misexamination. And they would publish pamphlets and books about it, again, to raise money to support these sorts of educational initiatives which are ongoing as part of that revivalism. So, people like Whitfield, Bliss, Edwards, Tennant, these are part of the whole gamut of furious preachers. If you've ever seen evangelical preachers on a TV show, especially in America, you'll know what I mean. Bible thumping, angry people. But they are effective. They do get responses. They do get increases in church membership. They do bring people to this emotional state where they will change their ways. They build lots of new churches. Often they're not expensive stone structures like Anglican churches, but simple wooden frame structures. I'll show you an example in a minute. In the South, especially in Virginia, there's a particularly strong revival led by the Baptists in the 1760s. And partly because the Baptists are interested in the poor.
They're not just interested in the rich, the elite, the people who've got money, who can give money towards the church and allow it to build big buildings. They're interested in the ordinary folks.
And religion in Virginia does become something of a class issue. It becomes something where the rich are increasingly Anglican and the poor are increasingly Baptists. And when the revolution came, more than 20% of Virginians are Baptists. And it's an interesting statistic that. And the best book to read on this sort of thing is Rhys Isaacs' book. It's called The Transformation of Virginia. It's very good on the Baptists in the development of the Virginian society. So here is a traditional Anglican church. This is St. James's Goose Creek, built in 1715. It looks a bit shabby in the photograph, but now it's been painted. It's really very pretty. It's painted white. It's quite pretty inside. And you even get the Royal Coat of Arms, which are still above the pulpit. Anglicanism was always a bit of a bastion, you know, in Low Country, South Carolina. But again, you get the pulpit raised up the steps, so you look over and you dominate the congregation. You know, and there's the symbolism of, you know, God and King, and they're all interrelated, aren't they? Here, however, is the South Key Baptist Church in Virginia in 1775. Bit of a simpler building. It probably took about 2 days to build. Well, if you had a lot of people helping. And inside, just a simple table, chairs, no big pulpit for the king. It brings religion right to the masses, so much more immediate. Instead of something being way, way away, distant, aloof, different, separate from the people, here he is, right in amongst the people. And you can illustrate the number of churches by looking at contemporary pictures of landscapes, townscapes. Here is the city of New York, and if you count, there are 7 steeples. And that's in 1730. 40 years later, there are 18 identified religious buildings. In fact, the only ones that are not religious that are numbered here are fort, prison, and the college. And that's just in New York. It happens everywhere. But the Great Awakening is not welcomed universally, everyone, you know, sitting around going how wonderful it all is. There are significant areas of opposition. A lot of traditional ministers dislike revivalism. Why do they dislike revivalism? Well, if you've ever seen evangelicals preach, then they may not be your cup of tea either. They are overly emotional. They will cry. And especially if you imagine British Reserve traditional British reserve doesn't fit well with being very overly emotional. It also isn't based on rationality. It's not based on reason. It's not based on education. It's based on emotion. Which is, a lot of English people at the time would say that's a very feminine thing. Decisions based on emotion rather than reason. Furthermore, often, changes brought about by the Great Awakening are all about sort of anti-hierarchies. They're anti-establishments. They're anti-bishops or anti-priests. They're talking about bringing religion to the masses, to the ordinary folks, to the ordinary people, showing them how to be Christian. Well, you don't need these, you know, lots of complicated church hierarchies getting in the way. So, you get those clashes against established hierarchies, and you get a backlash. For example, Baptists in Virginia talked about the sort of extravagance of traditional ministers, traditional Anglicans. But because the Anglicans are also in control of the local government, they sometimes have these Baptist ministers arrested as troublemakers. They've been whipped, especially if they're itinerant. You know, where's your livelihood? They arrest them as vagabonds, or as, you know, paupers. And also, if you are a member of an established church, for example, the Church of England, the growth of dissenters undermines your legitimacy. Where, if the CUP is supported by universal taxation, then why should that happen where perhaps 20, 30, 40% of the people don't belong to that church? You know, undermines that sense of legitimacy. So you can, again, you can see why Anglicans, traditional Anglicans, you know, would be defensive about Whitfield and people like him. They also disabuse, evangelicals, they sort of disabuse the power of learning. They sort of tap into that anti-intellectual streak, which is popular in America. You don't need to go to college to learn about God. I can tell you everything about God. God spoke to me. What's the use of all those highfalutin, you know, degrees and, you know, studying for divinity and all that sort of stuff? You don't need to do that. You just need to feel God in your heart. And again, that's a popular argument amongst the people who generally aren't well educated. And so you get satires of Whitfield appearing in England and in America. Here you've got, you know, devils squirting things in his ears. They call him Dr. Squintum. Apparently he got a squint. And the idea that he's collecting money or goods, you know, raising money for his own projects, taking them away from poor widows, depriving the poor of their livelihoods in order to, you know, get himself rich. These are the sort of satires that appear. Here's another one. See, he's got in his hand Maxim Cash. And again, trying to say how sort of simple the people are. People say, oh, what a pious preacher he is, and all sorts of things. Whitfield's an interesting character, partly because he gets, because he earns quite a bit of money from his preaching tours to support his orphanage. He even ends up buying a plantation in South Carolina and owning slaves in order to support his, you know, missionary work. So it's slightly incongruous. So, the fact that the Great Awakening reaches out to poor whites, slaves, the marginalised, oppressed peoples of society doesn't endear it to the wealthy, the rich. Gradually, opposition to the Great Awakening, those opposed to the Great Awakening, the changes, become known as the old side, or the old lights, conversely the supporters of the new side and the new lights. So sometimes you get a sort of a fight, not a literal fight, but you know, conflict over control of a church and control of a congregation between these two groups. Generally the old siders are older people, more conservative generally. Often they're first generation settlers from England. The new siders are generally younger, they're often born in America. Furthermore, new side ministers, those leading the Great Awakening, are often born and educated in America, at places like Harvard and Yale, and found things like Princeton. The old side ministers are usually educated at Oxbridge or at some of the Scottish universities. There are exceptions, of course, you know, Whitfield educated at Oxford, but as a generality, I think that is true. And there is something in there, a division between more conservative elements, which are often more closely tied with Britain, and more radical changing elements, which are more tied with America. So how do you explain it? Well, there are some secular explanations. I won't delve too deeply into the religious explanations. I mean, you could say it's God reaching down from heaven and persuading people their sinfulness, but I think I'll concentrate on the more secular explanations. You've got a war. The War of Austrian Succession. Starts in the late 1730s. Spreads into America. It does lead to economic problems, increasing poverty, and vagrancy. Makes times economically uncertain. So people are probably more generally concerned about their livelihood. You have a disease epidemic, a diphtheria epidemic in New England, which does kill more than 20,000 people. Many of them are children. So it reminds people of their own mortality and of the mortality of their families. Perhaps praying, perhaps being more religious, might help assuage God's wrath. In September of 1739, you've got a major slave rebellion in South Carolina, in Stone, and again, that reminds people of their own mortality. So you've got societies which, you know, society has got tensions in it. There are reasons why people are, you know, frightened, I guess. And if you're sort of staring death in the face, then religion becomes a lot more appealing. It becomes something much more that you're prepared to consider, take on board. And if you've got charismatic preachers who talk about repentance, who talk about, they have got the solution. This is all you need to solve all your problems in life, is to come and believe and give yourself wholly to God. Then, you know, that message is going to resonate. So these are some of the reasons where you might think people are get a little bit more open to ideas of religious revivalism. So, I mentioned this at the start, but let's go back to it here. Does the Great Awakening have an impact on the Gorsh, on the Gorsh Revolution? On the American Revolution? I think the Great Awakening does help to weaken the religious links between Britain and the colonies, partly because it makes Anglicanism weaker. It makes Anglicanism more elitist, less a religion of the people. And of course, Anglicanism is very closely associated with the monarchy. Remember, the king or the queen is head of the Church of England. So anti-Anglicanism is sort of also anti-monarchanism, anti-monarchical. Secondly, the Great Awakening is a unifying event in America. And it's a unifying event in the sense that it touches the lives of hundreds, you know, indeed thousands of colonists. Because it reaches almost every place, which either personally or, you know, tangentially. And so America has something of a common religious experience in the mid-18th century, an experience of revivalism. And that experience of revivalism and evangelicalism does help, in part, to define the American character. The Great Awakening acts as a significant stimulus to printing, publishing, mass methods of communication, including newspapers, are stimulated partly to report on these sorts of things, to print sermons. And these methods of communication, which grew up during this period, are very, very useful to Americans, because they help disseminate news of what's happening elsewhere in America and what's happening in Britain, which, you know, will become really important during the revolutionary crisis. The Great Awakening also spreads the language of Calvinism. For example, that loyalty to God is above all. It overrides loyalty to state, which is a very Calvinistic thought, you know, being used by Calvinists to justify the overthrow of Mary Queen of Scots, you know, as early as mid-16th century. So, it helps to shape Republican thought, you know, in a very crucial way. And most patriots, those who were leading the American Revolution, are actually new lights, or have been new lights. And they're able to associate Britain with sin, sinfulness. The British side is wrong, it's evil, it's sinful. The American side is the pure, good, noble side. And, you know, these arguments are persuasive. They're not only persuasive, but they're sort of, you know, very artfully done. They're cleverly done. However, you can't get away from the time lag. Great Awakening, apart from in Virginia, is mainly in the 1630s and 40s. The revolution is in the 1670s. So that's a big gap to bridge. So it's not a done deal, but I think there are certainly elements of that which are important to the American Revolution, but just elements, not, you know, lots and lots of things.